Ladies and gentlemen, pay attention. This is your boy, the coach from the WWE. I would like to welcome you to the very first wrestling podcast in the world to take you on a weekly deep dive into classic matches along with legends of the squared circle. Enjoy the discussion. Enjoy the back and forth. There's so much to get into. Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Payoff.
Woo! This is Tom Healy, and as always, I am joined by Jeff Ryan. Jeff, how was my woo?
That was good. That was.
I don't do many woos, so yeah. Unless I'm chopping someone, of course.
You really got to commit to it, and you committed to it, and so that was good.
Yeah.
To hear it.
That's like when I do my savage voice. You gotta lose yourself in it. You know, if you're trying to sound cool, I mean, you have to take a step back and go, I'm imitating a professional wrestler.
Well, and that's in you and I know, like, yeah, if you're gonna be a wrestler, you gotta commit to the character. So that's the way to do it.
Hey man, the most successful ones are always the ones that commit to their character, even if the gimmick's stupid, even if the storyline sucks. I mean, it always helps you to just own it. And it reminds me of an interesting story. Did you catch, it was on Jericho's podcast, the Revolt, the former Revival?
No, I have not listened to that one yet. No.
Did you see the pictures circulating in regards to the outfit that Vince McMahon wanted them to wear?
Oh, yeah, I did see that, yes.
So it's interesting. They were talking about, so of course, I Google it because I had not seen the picture. I look at it, it's terrible. But they started walking through the storyline, and I was like, that actually would have been so different that if they would have embraced it, which they said they would have, I actually think it could have worked.
Yeah, agreed.
And it was different enough. I'm like, man, I actually wish they would have done it. Like, it's something I would have watched. And for those of you that don't know, basically, you know, they had these ridiculous outfits, right? And so, of course, you're like, oh, Vince is like messing with them. But the whole idea was they were going to cut a promo and basically say, look, you want us to be clowns? You don't want us to be tag team wrestlers? You want us to like do all this stuff? Great, then we're going to do it just to piss you off. Like, that was the whole like idea. And that's actually pretty interesting, right? It's different. We don't get different very often in wrestling. And I feel like when we do, more often than not, fans appreciate it, especially for two guys like that, that they absolutely love.
Well, and I remember when we had our day at the PC that they were very, they were in character for most of the day. But I remember when we had like that question and answer at the end of the day, it was Dash, actually, I think it was, very articulate. Like these guys, like I was buying into them and just their real life person. He was talking about his family and like, you know, doing all this stuff. And so, and yeah, it seemed to be just really good guys, but yeah, just good stuff. But yeah, who knows what we got. Actually, I think it was Dawson, but anyways, yeah. So
yeah, we got a fun one more with those guys. We got a really good one here.
Yeah, we got one wrestler that's been the same person forever that is his real life, and then one that has reinvented himself, you know, into something different. So this should be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one, dude. So go ahead, plug our stuff real quick, and then let's get started.
Yeah, of course, and you all know it. It's at Payoff Pod, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff. And so, and of course, make sure to subscribe to the show, spread the word about the show, all that good stuff. And so, and this week we are saying coronavirus, unlike WWE. And so, yeah, we're going to keep it real, all that good stuff. And so, and of course, we got those three parts of the show. Everybody knows that: the build, the payoff, the aftermath, that before, during, after, all that good stuff. So, Tom, how come you wanted to do this one?
So obviously, you know, this was around WrestleMania 6. I was 6 years old. I was a big WWF fan, didn't watch a ton of WCW, started hearing about this Sting guy. And dude, this is the coronation, man. This is when Sting became the Stinger. This is a huge moment. And so I'm just excited to see it. And what an interesting guest, the guy that trained the damn guy. So, and he had some just awesome stories, as you guys are going to hear. So it's a really fun one, and big moment, big match, big coronation. I'm pumped for it. What about you?
Yeah, this is one too. I feel like so many people, you know, maybe our age, a little bit younger, remember the black and white Sting or the red and black Sting. They don't remember this Sting. They don't remember what, you know, when he started, he was a totally different person. And so not different.
I so prefer this. The Crow stuff, maybe I'm in the minority here. It was okay. You know, and maybe if they would have booked him better when he, you know, went against Hogan after the long layoff. But yeah, just didn't do it for me, man. Like, I never really liked the Crow gimmick. I just always loved the Surfer Sting. And it's cool to evolve, but I don't know. I miss this Sting.
Well, and that was, who was it? William Regal, a couple different wrestlers were saying, like, if you can't reinvent yourself, you're not going to make it. And Sting, total reinvention on this one. And so,
where did he say that, Regal?
Regal, he's just said it over the years, I want to say. I remember.
Man, dude, that's so true. And then you start thinking about these guys and you're like, Austin obviously reinvented himself. Yeah. Shawn Michaels, Triple H, Bray Wyatt now, Undertaker. I mean, the list goes on, right? But it's like, you know, some of the best of all time, there's just various versions of them. Hulk Hogan, Macho Man.
But it's funny, I attribute it to Regal because I think that's who I saw from. He might have been quoting someone else. I don't know. And it's funny you say Undertaker because we start getting into this. We did have
I know.
Well, I don't want to spoil it, but yes, we'll talk about it when you get there. And so, I'm just excited because it's just an era that we haven't really spent a ton of time in and kind of talking about really the inception of what Sting was and kind of, you know, starting to get him to be a superstar. And so I'm excited for that. So if you're ready for the build time, I think I'm ready for it.
If you're ready, I'm ready.
Let's do it.
It's time for the build.
Oh, it's time for the build.
All right, dude. So here we are. Great American Bash 1990. This is coming hot off the heels of WrestleMania 6. Jeff, why have I referenced WrestleMania 6 twice? Do you know?
I don't.
Because the Warrior wins the world title from the WWF at WrestleMania 6, and then his training partner, his tag team partner, the guy he broke into the business with, Steve Borden, Sting, wins the world title just a few months later. And I think that is so cool. And maybe that's been mentioned before, but I didn't realize it until we sat down with Rick Baspin. I'm like, 1990, wait a second. Like, this was right around the same time. How cool is that? And a lot of parallels, right? Both guys look like $1 million, great physiques, had the paint, weren't Ric Flair in the ring, you know, little raw in the ring. But man, I thought that was so cool. So Great American Bash 1990, always a big pay-per-view for WCW. Baltimore Arena in Baltimore, Maryland held about 14,000. So, and I don't know much about the Baltimore Arena. I don't know who would have played in there. I guess that probably at the time was like Baltimore, where they would have concert venues and stuff. And I really don't know much about the building. Should have looked it up. Maybe I will, but because, you know, they don't have like the NBA team and the NHL team, but pretty big venue and obviously a great wrestling town. So we kick this show off, Brian Pillman defeating Buddy Landell. they went 9 minutes. Then we have Mike Rotunda, recently released Mike Rotunda, father of Bo Dallas and Bray Wyatt. He defeated the Iron Sheik in 6 minutes. Doug Furness defeating Dutch Mantel. Ironically, I didn't realize like Doug Furness had been around by himself as a single star. Of all places, I heard of Doug Furness reference just the other day from Harvey Whippleman, who was a guest on Corey Graves' podcast. You ever listen to his podcast?
I don't, because I'm not a big Corey Graves fan.
So I don't like him. I don't like the character he tries to portray. I don't think I'd like him if I met him in real life. I don't know. And then even in his work, I think he like tries too hard and he tries to like be guys from the past. The guy does nothing for me. but he gets interesting guests on his podcast sometimes. And it's like, oh, well, where else are you going to hear, you know, 30 minutes of Triple H just, you know, letting his guard down and shooting the shit, right? Right. And I happened to just click on Harvey Whippleman. I was like, that's random, and still working behind the scenes, which I thought was pretty cool. But yeah, it mentioned Doug Furness. So there you go there. Harley Race defeating Tommy Rich in 6 minutes. You know, Jeff, I know a lot of people love Harley Race. I just never really saw much of his work, man. I think we're a little young for that.
We are. The one thing I learned, especially, is him against Sad, and I kind of referenced it before because I had recently watched the Dark Side of the Ring Benoit stuff, was Race saying, don't do the headbutt. It'll, you know, it hurts your spine, all this other stuff.
Oh, and, I know. That's right.
Yeah, and that was the comment he made on that. Did the diving headbutt, told him don't do it. And then there was somebody else, I forget who else was doing it again, like hurt himself. And then
it was a Dynamite Kid.
Dynamite Kid. Thank you. Yep. And then, you know, Benoit, you know, what happened there? So yeah, just, you know, and I recently, you know, was it just last year, passing away too? No, about a year now at this point, but yeah, just, I agree with you though. Just didn't see a ton.
And like, I mean, look, we're obviously two wimps. I mean, we're not pro wrestlers or professional athletes, but dude, just think about.
Speak for yourself, buddy. Come on.
Like, okay. I'll speak for myself. I'm a wimp and not a pro athlete. So dude, with all due respect, you're not a pro athlete either.
I'm not either. Yes.
But can you imagine just like, and again, I know it's a work. I know you're not slamming him in, you know, as hard as you can with your head, but just, I don't know. I mean, I wake up with a stiff neck because I slept the wrong way. Like, can you imagine just the trauma of hitting your head against something, your neck, kind of that blow, even if instead of it being a massive impact, it's just an inch or two blowback, dude, it's gotta fuck you up.
Well, and that's, it's, you know, I question when you see like some clips of some wrestlers talking about it and they just start laughing, and I'm wondering if that's because they are going crazy, like, you know. So some of it, yeah, just insane, but I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, not that chair shots to the head wouldn't be bad either, but I don't know, something with like the diving headbutt in terms of just the whiplash and the neck stuff and what that would do to the brain. We then had Midnight Express, Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane, that the NWA US Tag Team Champions, that's a mouthful, defeating the Southern Boys of Steve Armstrong and Tracy Smothers. Vader defeating Tom Zink, 2 minutes. A lot of short matches on this show. Steiner Brothers defeating the Fabulous Freebirds. That'd be a fun match, 13 minutes. What else do we have here? Dudes with Attitudes. That's El Gigante, okay, also known as Giant Gonzalez. Junkyard Dog and Paul Orndorff. That's a team.
That's a hell of a team. Yeah.
Defeating the Four Horsemen of Arn Anderson, Barry Windham, and Sid Vicious by DQ in 8 minutes. A lot going on there. Yeah. But Jeff, man, I'm pumped to talk about this one.
Yes.
Lex Luger, the NWA US champion. Who did he defeat? Mean Mark Callis, better known as The Undertaker. Oh, and by the way, accompanied by Paulie Dangerously, Paul Heyman. I went back and watched this match.
Did you? Oh, my God.
Earlier this week. The match sucked, but let me tell you something. And look, it's easy to say, right? Oh, well, it's The Undertaker. Of course you're going to say this. But, dude, go back and watch him. He was big. He moved around. I mean, remember, when he went to the WWF, they said, you got to slow down, work half as fast, work like a big man, you know, not be doing. But he was just moving around like crazy, super athletic. Kind of, you know who he reminded me of was a little bit like Mike Awesome.
Yep.
Just the look and the size and the way he was moving around. Really cool.
It is very weird, because I just pulled up a picture at least real quick. Extremely weird seeing The Undertaker in trunks.
Yeah, and he's got like just like the pale, like freckly skin and stuff.
Yeah, this is one we will have to go back and watch a Mean Mark match for the show, because yeah, we'll try and find his best Mean Mark match.
I love it. I don't know if I call it the semi-main event, but the second to last match was Doom, which was Butch Reed and Ron Simmons. They're your NWA World Tag Team Championship, not to be confused with the U.S. Tag Team Championship. They defeat the Rock and Roll Express, Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson. A lot of talent on this show, but man, look at all the titles. We had, you know, the NWA U.S. tag titles, the NWA U.S. champion, the NWA World Tag, and then the NWA World Heavyweight. So four titles, no women's title, no other cruiserweight or anything. But yeah, titles have been around for a long time, but it does feel like in today's current product, it's just absolutely brutal how many of them you see. And then the main event, Sting, Ric Flair. That's why we're here. It's going to be really good. So I know there's a lot to cover on the build, so I want to jump right into it. But, man, good show and excited to cover this one. So how do we get the rub to Sting, man? How do we make this guy a main eventer? I'm curious about this. I know you did.
Yeah, I got a whole lot of notes on this one. So you have Sting starting in NWA. It was 1987. It was actually then March of 1988 where he began really feuding and kind of challenging Ric Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. Very quickly getting thrown right into these big name kind of feuds, because not just Ric Flair, but the Four Horsemen as well too. Now, you know, Tom already referenced the Four Horsemen and kind of the, you know, Sid Vicious being a part of them as well too. This is, I'm talking the OG Four Horsemen. This is Rick, Ole, Arn, and Tully. And so this is when they were absolutely at just really the pinnacle of what they were and kind of running the show as the Horsemen. And so you actually had through most of 1988, you had Sting tag team with Dusty Rhodes. Couple of different matches. One of their big ones, though, was them taking on the Road Warriors, Hawk and Animal. I know there's, again, a dark side that we've been referencing a lot because I've been watching it lately, but, you know, a episode with them on that one as well, too, that was pretty good. And so, kind of fast forwarding a little bit, yeah, that the tag team in 1988, I'm interested, Tom, in your thoughts on this quote that I find. It said, after a long push, Sting won his first title in NWA when he defeated Mike Rotunda, as we know, IRS, of course, talked about him, for the NWA Television Championship at a live event in March 1989. Sting defended the television title actively, but tended to face subpar challengers such as the Iron Sheik. Would you consider the Iron Sheik to be a subpar challenger?
I mean, the guy was a heel. I don't know. I mean, it was a dastardly heel. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, the subpar. So now kind of getting into this a little bit here, you had the great, actually, just the famous wrestler, he actually challenging Sting. This was a time when there were some things going on with New Japan. This was Great American Bash 1989. He'll come into play throughout this story as well too, but the main event of this year's, or that year's, 1989's Great American Bash, had Ric Flair defending the NWA World Heavyweight Championship against the one and only Terry Funk, who was a member, and I did not remember this, of the JTEX Corporation.
I have never heard that before.
And so this
what is that?
I did a little bit of research on this one. It was just a heel stable, managed by one Gary Hart. And so just really a kind of side feud to the Horsemen as well too. Now I was curious as well too, again, kind of who was a member of this, because I had no idea who the members of this were. Terry Funk, of course, being one. The Great Muta, as we already said, is another one who was involved in this group. And then some names that I had not ever heard of. You had Dick Slater would be one. The Dragon Master, or Mr. J, as it had it, who was, a New Japan wrestler. And then Buzz Sawyer, who was another one that, again, did not remember Buzz Sawyer. So we had a few people here that, also deceased, but, part of this crew that this was a new one to me, because this is not something that you and I ever followed.
I can hear all the confusion in your voice.
Yeah, because it's just, we got some weird names on this one. But so important, though, to understand. So after Flair, though, got the victory over Terry Funk in this one, he was actually attacked by part of that stable, the Great Muta. Sting actually came to the ring, even though he had been feuding with Flair because Muda and Sting had their feud going on. And so the two of them, or four of them really, Funk, Muda, Sting, and Flair, actually had some back and forth between each other that summer. It was actually a Thunderdome cage match, which we are big fans of Thunderdome around here. Which Sting and Flair actually won. That was Halloween Havoc 1989. So you had Flair. You had Flair and Sting. Well, Sting joining, which was at this point a newly reformed and now faced Four Horsemen along with the Anderson. So you had the four of these guys. And so it was actually, and it's so interesting though. So it's important to understand, like, Sting now is like part of the Horsemen. And this is, again, reminder for everyone, this is not White and Black Sting. This is, you know, Surfer Sting. So something to keep in mind on that one. So what you had though is Sting wrapping up the year. He actually won an Iron Man tournament, which the competitors were Sting, Luger, Flair, and the Great Muda. Sting actually beat Flair that Starcade that night, which gave him enough points, which is how the tournament was kind of being tabulated, to win it. Because Sting won, he then became the number one contender for Ric Flair's NWA world title. So you've got these two guys that are in the Horsemen now, with one of them having the title and one of the other members having a number one contender shot. So as you can assume where this goes, you had Sting getting kicked out of the Four Horsemen. This was February 1990 Clash of Champions, after Sting would not give up that title shot. And so then, of course, you had the rivalry restarting at this point. So like we said, this was, you know, we're 1990 at this point, February. It's not till summer where this match happens, but already you can see a lot of history, a lot of different things of why these guys were, you know, feuding and then together and then separate. And I really enjoy kind of, you know, where we get to this point. So unfortunately, though, where he wouldn't relinquish his title, Sting actually hurt himself in a steel cage match. And so a lot of different things happening. It was actually, he got replaced by Ole Anderson, that Sting ran to the cage to try and climb it, but blew out his knee. And so because of that, it was unfortunate that he had to miss some time, had to go away. But throughout all that though, he was still kind of in the stories and kind of feuding, and it was at least kind of on camera, which is weird to think about that now, like blew out his knee, but he was still working, not matches, but was still doing what he had to do. It kind of speaks to the popularity of what Sting was at that time. So Lex Luger actually, so Flair needed an.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time a guy was hurt and then they like just kept him on TV the entire time.
Right, exactly. So you had Wrestle War 1990, that Flair now needing a new opponent. And so you have Lex Luger challenging Ric Flair at Wrestle War. It was actually during this match that Sting came down to motivate Luger, and that, you know, before, you know, Sting and Luger had been feuding as well too. And so eventually you get to the point where, you know, Sting got attacked by one of the Andersons, and then Luger, instead of going after Flair, decided to help Sting, and then Luger actually lost the match because of count out, because he was helping Sting. And so Flair still holding onto the belt at this point. So interesting kind of note that I have on this one, and it's one that I'll have to dig into a little bit more and kind of, you know, find some info on this, but it was actually that at the time they wanted Flair to drop the title to Luger, but Flair said that he had promised Sting that he was going to hold the belt until he could drop it to Sting. And so I thought that was really interesting of, like, you know, doing the work and trying to help put over the younger guy. Imagine if he was in that story the whole time and was able to capitalize on that. But again, Sting being a part of this and being on TV, one of the weirdest pieces of this story, which I was wondering why, and Tom, you know, no idea why this was happening, but Capital Combat, this was May of 1990.
Yep.
I was seeing photos of Sting with RoboCop, and I had no idea why I was seeing photos of Sting and RoboCop. Well, of course, maybe I'm the odd man out here, but of course, it was a promotional crossover for RoboCop 2, which had just come out recently, that 1990. And of course, Sting, there was an angle where Sting was rescued by RoboCop, which there were some promos that were really weird, but Sting looked, and you and I had talked about it before we got here, Sting looked jacked as hell. That's one thing we have not talked about at this point, that this dude, he had just a giant chest, huge, like Sting was jacked. It was incredible. And so, but you had, again, this Capital Combat with Sting had gotten locked in a cage by the Four Horsemen. This is actually on the network. You can search Sting and RoboCop and it will come up. It was interesting because I really enjoyed the line from JR on that show of like, great ovation for RoboCop as he makes his way to the ring, which you'll never hear anything like that in anything other than wrestling. But I did enjoy, there was another clip of Road Dogg watching this, and he called it flimsy, like the majority of WCW booking in the 90s, which I thought was pretty funny. And so, the meme you and I shared earlier this week, I don't watch WWE because it's fake. And then when people tell us that, and then we tell them, like, well, do you watch movies because they're real? It's like, well, you know, this is what wrestling is. And so, so you really had, though, up until Sting getting injured, up until that point, like really February until this match of July, Sting was hurt, but he was still in storylines. He was still getting saved by RoboCop. Like, you had all these things going on and happening. And so he was at least still being a part of that story. So we get to this match, though, you know, with all of these different things happening and the different components and the people being involved. And so a little nutty, like some of these stories that we've been telling and the builds on these, but we got here and that's where we wanted to. So Tom, thoughts on any of this madness?
Do you know what RoboCop was rated, like, in terms of like how old you had to be?
I don't, but I know if it was anything like movies were back then, I'm going to say it was maybe PG-13.
It was rated R.
Was it? Okay.
And the only reason I remember this is because my grandfather thought it was like a superhero movie and took me, and it was like, you know, he got in some shit from my mom for that.
Definitely not.
Yeah, because I was like 6 years old. It took me to an R-rated movie just thinking, oh, this is like, you know, like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or something, you know? And it was rated R.
I remember I was a RoboCop fan because he was from Detroit. And so I had that connection to him.
It gives you something in common if you were ever to meet him.
Which, yeah, very, very realistic in that point. And then I enjoyed, too, I think their car was like a Ford Taurus was the cop car in that movie, which I just found super comical. But especially looking back nowadays, like a Ford Taurus really catching up to those high-speed pursuits. So good stuff. But, yeah, so you got any final thoughts on the build here?
Well, it might have been an upgraded Ford Taurus.
Yeah, never know that. A couple extra cylinder, liters.
Oh
yeah,
no! I think the upgrade. I think they made a V8 Ford Taurus back then. So
right, yeah.
So if you want to watch this with us, we got Rick Bassman here. We're at the 2 hour 27 and 30 second mark. A Great American Bash 1990. Again, that's the 2 hour 27 minute 30 second portion of the Great American Bash 1990 on the WWE Network. Awesome guest, awesome match. You're really going to like this. So with that being said, let's get to the payoff.
Ho! It's time for the payoff.
All right, we are here with Mr. Rick Bassman. Rick, welcome to the payoff.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me. This will be fun.
So you have a unique relationship with Sting. Just quickly walk through, how did you find him? What did you initially think of him? And how was he when you first got to know him?
Okay, great. Well, as you know, we talked about in the last episode, I'm sorry. Are we allowed to reference?
No, we can. We're breaking the third wall, as they say. Yeah. So we're filming these, and you already spoke a little bit about that, but we're airing them in sequential order. So if you haven't gone back in the archives and listened to them, you should do so. We already covered WrestleMania 6 with one of your other proteges, Ultimate Warrior. So yeah, talk to us a little bit specifically about Sting, where you came across him, and you know, a little bit about him.
Excellent. So Warrior and Sting and two others, as you know, were part of a superhero team I put together for pro wrestling, initially called Team America, that eventually became Power Team USA and lost the Team America name in a trademark search, or trademark dispute, I should say. The group were to be four guys, a black guy, an American Indian, an all-American guy, and an Italian-American. And I cast the group, for lack of a better word, and pretty quickly lost our first blonde-haired blood All-American boy. So I was looking for a replacement. And myself and the three other team members were training at a Gold's Gym in Reseda, California. And we're there pretty much daily. And there's a guy behind the counter, who's like the day manager, who's like this really nice, really mellow, really mild-mannered guy. Big guy, good physique, good-looking guy, really nice. You could tell he's genuine. And he didn't quite have like blonde hair. It was kind of like light brown, but whatever. We all can make changes. And I approached him one day and I said, "Hey, Steve, would you be interested in being a pro wrestler?" And he said, "No interest whatsoever." I don't know if it was exact words, but that was the sentiment and pretty close to the delivery. And I got to tell you, man, I worked on him for probably 5-6 days a week for like a month. Tell him, here's what we're doing, here are the plans, here's what could result. And again, he was a day manager at a gym and probably wasn't making a lot of money. He was married, very smart guy, very pragmatic. And he goes, "Man, I hear about pro wrestling and the lifestyle, probably kill my marriage. My marriage is the most important thing to me." And I mean, he had all the right reasons for not doing it. But for better or for worse, I eventually wore him down, or he just he joined our Power Team USA group in training, and that started the legend of the guys now known as Sting.
And what's interesting about that too is you hear guys that are reluctantly brought into wrestling. It wasn't something they grew up, you know, wanting to do, and they come and go. Then you have a guy like Sting. I mean, he's a wrestler's wrestler. He's still doing appearances. He wrestled for the better part of 30 years. You know, so not only did he get into the business, but it was a huge part of his life for a long period of time. And you can tell he loves it, or else he wouldn't be out there doing appearances and face paint and doing the interviews, because he probably doesn't need the money.
No. As a matter of fact, I know he doesn't now. And he does have a true affinity for it. He's really connected to the business. He picks his spots more and more these days. Why wouldn't he? He has the ability to do so. But yeah, like you said, he really got into it. I mean, look at this match here. This was when Ric Flair was the guy. Ric Flair was the guy, and Hulk Hogan was the guy. So there were two the guys. And Warriors, we know, dethroned one. And here's Sting. A few years after I met him and talked him into being a pro wrestler, he's taken down the guy. It's pretty freaking amazing.
So how was your relationship with him at this time in 1990?
We weren't really in touch for many, many years. Right around this time, I'd say 91, I was an executive for the Walt Disney Company, and I was in status two of the Orlando, Florida property. And I got friendly there when I was working there with Eric Bischoff, and then with a lot of the brass at WWF to provide a Disney connection to that. I actually brought two different pro wrestling properties to Disney. So I was in touch with all the brass, and I got myself invited to go backstage WCW when they were in town. I think it may have been Daytona Beach, and Steve was there, and we saw each other. We said hello. We had a nice chat. He said to me, he goes, "Hey, you know, I want you to know that all those years ago, that wasn't my idea to walk out. You know, Jim pushed me in that direction." And he said it in a way that was very earnest, where I didn't feel like he was necessarily just trying to get something, you know, off his chest or put the blame on someone else. I think he just felt like he wanted to tell me that. After that, we weren't in touch for probably another 10 years until I started UPW, and that was my promotion in California. And UPW really took off, and we had this funny rep. We became known as a place that would book top guys from WWF, WCW, ECW that had never done quote unquote indie shots. And not only would they come work for us, they would actually put our guys over, which is pretty unheard of. And there one night I wanted to do something where Sting would come in and work. And I wouldn't dare ask him to go under anybody. Obviously, he was one of the top stars in the business. Turned out WCW wouldn't let him work, but he said, hey, I can do an appearance at your show. So I ended up booking him. And this is really cool. I had three tables side by side. Sting, Ivory, when she was the WWF champion. I had retrained her after Glow and got her to WWF. And then Rob Van Dam, who at the time was a top dog in ECW. So we had all three of them side by side, which was pretty cool. And when it came time for the payoff, Sting wouldn't take any money from me, which I thought was pretty nice.
Wow. So, you know, obviously you look at Sting, you look at Ultimate Warrior, you know, go on down the line of the Cenas and the Mizes and all these guys that you've helped, right? And I'm not saying that you've taken all the credit for, obviously you haven't, but you facilitated their growth in the business. You helped them. You put some polish on it, whatever you want to call it. But what's the secret? Why have you, and I say you as in your system and the things that you were doing in California, what's the secret? I mean, how did so much talent make it to the big time? Is it you picked out the right guys? Is it you got them working to their strengths? What is it?
Well, it's a whole combination of things. One would be, first of all, that, you know, WWF and WCW both at that time gravitated toward big bodies. You know, this is the era of the, you know, the Warlord and all the guys like him, Sid Vicious, and that is how it was back then. And those guys tended to congregate in California. So, you know, first thing is I can take zero credit for being geographically lucky. That's part of it. Where I would give myself credit is, you know, I've always been a hustler, and I worked very, very hard to put that first school together and to put those shows together. And, you know, there'll be people out there, you know, I like to refer to them as the JCs, and I don't mean our good friend Jesus, but I'm talking about Jim Cornette and John Cena in particular, who will go on and on about how I, now it does become an I, it doesn't become UPW anymore, how I took advantage of them and, you know, took money out of the boys' pockets and whatnot. And I mean, I know it's a long answer to a short question. I tend to do that, and I apologize. But man, I'll tell you, Tom, I worked my ass off for years to have a school and be able to pay the rent and the insurance. I actually had insurance before wrestling promoters thought insurance would be a good thing to have in case someone got hurt. And we used it on several occasions to pay instructors, to do everything that it took to have a wrestling school and a wrestling promotion. And, you know, I have to just say this because I have the form now. I remember many nights when I go back to my one-bedroom apartment with my wife, and we would wonder how we were going to pay our personal bills, because I was putting the wrestling bills first to make sure the school stayed alive. And in doing that, it was providing a place for guys like John Cena to train for free and so on and so forth. So half was where we were. Top was the hustle and the platform that I put together, that others helped me put together, just from sheer hustle and inertia. And then the big carrot eventually were the relationships I was able to form outside of UPW with WWF, with New Japan, with Zero One, so on and so forth.
Well, and look, the way I hear it is, someone that owns a couple businesses, is you set up a business model, you invested, you created an environment. It was certainly different than the quote unquote traditional wrestling school, but you set up a platform and folks could choose to be a part of that and reap the benefits and situation or not. I don't understand what's wrong with that. I mean, you invested in them. You put the right situation together. Look, if NXT runs a show, yeah, they're running a business. They've got bills to pay. And I don't understand how it's really any different, right?
Well, yeah, the difference then was there was, you know, first of all, kayfabe was still kind of like hovering in existence and whatnot. And the old school was still there. You know, the guys that were coming up were frowned upon if they hadn't averaged 500 mile drives to shows and survived sleeping in the backseat of a car eating tuna fish. People thought that's how it should be still. And, you know, guys like Jim Cornette, is one of those guys. I mean, I kind of like half jokingly challenge him to a fight every now and then, saying I'll buy his plane ticket and all that nonsense. I would never want to go promo against him. It's a guy who would kill me. He's a promo master, and I know that. But he's one of the guys like Warrior. I'd love to sit down with him and just talk. I don't feel like I need to explain myself, but Jim was a guy and is a guy who was so steeped in the old school. It's like when WWF announced Tough Enough, he really couldn't say anything at the time because he was beholden to them. But when I came out with the Discovery Channel special, he went fucking nuts on me. That little fucking punk, Bassman, midgets exposing the business.
Yeah, I watched that clip an hour ago.
I'll tell him again. I would love to talk with him, but I don't think he'd ever be open to that. Who knows? Maybe I'm wrong, and he's way more enlightened than I could ever hope to be. I don't know. But I know that would happen with Cena, for instance, was, can I even talk about this? Are we too off topic?
Oh, no, this is great.
Okay. Yeah, with John, you know, you didn't have to be a genius to look at John and go, that guy has it. So that wasn't like I had any special eye for talent or anything like that. There are some people I might take a little credit for with that. You wouldn't know most of these people. Anybody can look at John and go, wow. We always hear about that undefinable it factor. If you meet John in person, he has that in spades. And he has a work ethic that's second to none. John came to my school. You can see that. Now, when I started this business, when I got into UPW and I started the wrestling school, here was the plan. And this is going to sound kind of crazy, but do you know people knowing Barry Bloom and Michael Braverman? Are those names familiar to you?
Sure. Especially Barry Bloom. He's come up a lot lately on Eric Bischoff's podcast.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Barry and Michael are partners. And at that time, they were managing Jesse Ventura and Dan Hunter and a whole bunch of others. And they're making a very good living doing that. I formed a partnership with Barry and Michael. And the idea was we would start this school. We would recruit tons of giant monsters. We would teach them how to be pro wrestlers. We would pay for that. The guys that started to show potential, we would then forgive them of any expenses. We would pay all their expenses. We would sign them to management contracts, and we would then bid them off to either WWF, WCW, or maybe ECW. That was our business model. It was a weird model.
What's funny is it's actually very common in golf and probably other sports as well. So it's not some crazy, I mean, you know, I'm just saying if people are listening going, well, that sounds horrible. It's very common that you're essentially investing in and bankrolling people to learn how to do a profession, right?
Yeah, exactly. And now this is my standpoint. I would love to sit here and talk with John Cena and see how he'd respond to the following, for instance. John came in, but now we also had paying students as well. I think it was like $250 a month, if I remember correctly. We offered a pretty big schedule of classes. John came in, he paid tuition for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. And he came to me one day and said, I cannot afford to pay this tuition. Can you let me go? Not let him go out of the school, let him go on the tuition. And, you know, already he and I, we didn't have much affinity for each other. That's putting it mildly. I wasn't a giant fan of the person, and I'm still not, but I was and still am a huge fan of, you know, just, well, the work ethic, of course. And then again, he has that whole charismatic factor that very few people ever would. So when he came to me on that, you know, I assumed he was going to be a guy that would make it and probably do really, really well. And I said, sure, John, let's sign you to management. We'll let you go. And he said, great. So that was that. And at that time, there was a show. That's reality TV was pretty new at that point. There was a show casting called Manhunt. And the casting call came across my desk as an adjunct of what I got then being in LA and Orange County with all these giants. Is I did a ton of movie and TV bookings for all these guys and commercial bookings, which was great money, especially for them in those days. This Manhunt deal came up. They wanted this one particular guy from my school. I thought John was a better choice. I pushed John very hard on these producers. They got interested. Then we got an offer, and the offer was $20,000. I'll never forget this. And through a lot of pushing and pulling, I was able to get John's offer up to $40,000. And this is a guy who just months before could not pay the $250 tuition for my school. And I'll never forget closing that deal. I was in my car in the parking lot of the Irvine Spectrum. It was mine and my wife's wedding anniversary that day. She was inside at the restaurant by herself for about 2 hours because I was in the car closing this deal. Bad priorities, I know, but that's what I did. And I called John with the news, and John's, the first thing he said to me was, oh man, well, hey, don't spend that $4,000 in one place. I mean, very, very magnanimous. And that, that kind of set the tone. Well, I mean, our relationship already was that. It set the tone for the rest of it. And then, you know, WWF, Bruce Pritchard would come around a lot, which was a blast. I love Bruce. JR would come around every now and then, which was great. It was so much fun when they'd come in. We would do a big showcase. And part of my job was to, and my staff helped with this also, Todd Kennelly, who you may know, is a TNA announcer. A few other people had amazing, amazing staff. Brett Wagner, this guy, Big Swag, who hates me now, who I still love. He was great. We would do reports on the talent. And dude, I pushed Cena to the moon because I thought he was going to be huge for them. And it would have been good for him, good for them, and good for me because I was his manager. And I got development deals. Back then, development deals were very hard to come by. They were very rare. And I got four development deals all at the same time. Aaron Aguilera, who became Jesus for a short period of time. Basil Bozinas, who passed away. And Justin McCulley, who became a UFC heavyweight fighter. He actually turned the deal down, which was shocking. The development deals then were $300 a week. That's what WWF paid the guys. I'm like, guys, you got to consider John Cena more carefully and more specially. First of all, he eats a ton. He's got to pay for that. Give him a couple hundred extra dollars so the guy can train the way he needs to train. And they agreed. So these four contracts came in the same day. And if you look at the Discovery Channel special, you'll see this moment where I get to hand the contracts up. You know, maybe that's a way of putting myself over. But I loved it. I was always genuinely happy to see people get an opportunity. So gave Aaron, Basil, and Justin their contracts for $300 each, gave John's for $500. Now, as an agent, you know, the deck is stacked against me. I'm short, Jewish, and I'm an agent. So I must be a crook, right, when you put those three things together, with a Napoleon complex, no less. So anyway, if you're an agent, and his initial offer was $300, and I got him $500, so I got him $200 more a week than he should have gotten, and he pays me 10% of his $500, that's $50. He still comes out $150 ahead of where he would have had he done the deal himself, right? And that's before all the work I did to set the school up and the work to push him and all that. So anyway, he paid me, they kept all the guys at UPW for a while, paid them for a few weeks. So John gave me his $50 a week. It was always begrudging on his part when he handed it to me. And I'll never forget, man, like the day after he got to Louisville, I got a one-line letter from him dismissing me as his manager. And I heard what had happened is that he got there and Cornette immediately went to work on him. Fuck that little piece of shit. No one puts their hands in the boys' pockets. And that's, you know, that's what happened from my perspective. They may have their own. I'm sure they do. But I believe I'm telling it pretty truthfully and pretty accurately.
Well, it's interesting. And I mean, I think it's interesting just learning about the way you set up things, the way you structured it from a business standpoint. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, it was, you know, different than what other people were doing. And totally. the stuff you were doing with the guys, I mean, it obviously worked. I mean, the guys you churned out of there and the stardom that they had certainly speaks for itself. So we watched Sting win the title, place goes crazy. You know, he becomes a major star because Flair puts him over and makes him look like $1 million. What's the current relationship like with Sting? How did, you know, it evolve with you and him over the years? You know, how do you feel about the performer and the man?
Well, as a performer, I mean, you talked about how Sting made, or Flair made Sting look like $1 million. I mean, Sting himself became $1 million in my opinion, using that same barometer. He's, in my opinion, one of the best of all time. He became amazing in the ring, amazing work physically, amazing psychology, great promos, and he looked the part. I mean, the guy was absolutely the complete package. What more can you say about that? You know, as far as a person goes, I mean, we were never good friends. We were never close friends, but I would absolutely typify him as a good guy. He's solid. He's a man of his word. He has integrity. I don't talk to him often. I would say, you know, since he handed me that initial investment back that I made in him in 1985, that we probably talked 20 times, maybe. And it's usually when I have a booking and he's taken some over the years and promptly sends me my 10%. Because yes, Jim Cornette, I still take 10% when I give people opportunities. And he's always been great to work with, man. It's just, he's a good dude.
So what are you, let's tell everyone, you said you're still taking some bookings, still doing some stuff. What's your current connection to the wrestling business?
Currently, I'm consulting for a company out of California. They're called the United Wrestling Network. They own two brands called Championship Wrestling from Arizona and Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. It's one of the two partners is a guy named David Marquez, who actually used to work for me back in the UPW and Valor Fighting days. And Dave has, with his partner, just like by spit and tissue paper, managed to put together a deal where they've got these two shows in about 70% of the markets throughout North America. It's pretty astounding accomplishments. They've done it with very, very little investment. And we are working on major, I know wrestling like uses such superlatives because we're showmen and exaggerators, but it'd be fair to use words like very, very major expansion that we're actually going to be approaching WWE with very shortly.
Wow, that's exciting. I'm sure it's fun for you to, you know, be in the game and still doing things all these years later.
Yeah, it's cool. And, you know, I do, and, you know, to stay alive, I live in Hawaii with my four pit bulls. I'm on Maui, you know, have that consulting deal, and I still do bookings. And by bookings, I mean, you know, TV shows, movies, commercials. I just talked to both to Charlie Haas and Jackie Gata this morning. I got them small bookings and something. And, you know, it's nice to... nice to stay in the mix. I actually had a very good potential deal for John Cena not long ago. And it was a lead in a movie, but I guess it wasn't quite at the level that he is earning at right now. And I mean that completely. I mean, he's an A-list star now, which again is amazing. And I thought it would have been a really cool opportunity to get back in touch and say hello and see if we could become, if not buddies, at least have a conversation, but not this time around, unfortunately.
Well, appreciate you sharing. We covered a lot of stuff here. It was fantastic, and Sting and all kinds of other business stuff. So really great time with you. Appreciate you being on the show, and have a great night.
Hey, you too. Hope I didn't talk you to death, man. Thank you.
No, this is great stuff. Thank you.
Ho! It's time for the aftermath.
All right. So, Jeff, gut thoughts, first thoughts. What'd you think of this one?
Just craziness, just so much happening, so many different people involved. Like, it just, you know, we recently talked about, like, you know, a match not getting overshadowed by, you know, people running in and things like that. This is one of those matches where that was not the case. Like, if you were looking for a 5-star on this one, not happening. Yeah.
So let me ask this. What'd you think of that Sting USA outfit?
I will always, like, I'm with you. Like, I actually do like the Raven Sting, but this was very good too.
So there, Sting did a live show at whatever StarCast I went to. I think it was number 2, the one in Vegas. Okay. So I asked him, I grabbed the mic. I was like, do you ever think about like doing the Sting, you know, the Surfer Sting later in your career? And he goes, dude, I lost all my hair. I couldn't if I wanted to. I was like, oh, okay.
It makes sense. So.
Yeah, I was looking for something, I guess, a little more profound. He's like, yeah, couldn't.
I guess that works. Okay. Thanks, Sting. So we got some aftermath things here. And of course, I do want to thank kind of Rick Bassman for kind of, you know, sitting down and talking about that one. Like I said, you know, as you're not aware, go back and kind of listen to some of the previous episodes we had with him, you know, talking about, you know, really, you know, building the Undertaker up to what he was, and or not the Undertaker, the Ultimate Warrior, and, you know, some of these guys really getting their start, John Cena, things like that. Some of those videos are just kind of fun to watch, but definitely go back, kind of check out some of those past episodes in the archives to kind of what we have and things like that. So, of course, you know, this main event, you had Ric Flair defeating, you know, they're, you know, retaining the NWA World Heavyweight Championship, you know, facing off against Sting. kind of interesting how this played out, because during the match, you really had the Steiners, you had Paul Orndorff, you had, like you said, like dudes with attitudes, you had, you know, them around the ring, you had El Gigante, you had Ole Anderson, you just had all these different things, you know, kind of happening. Just really crazy. There's no other way to cut it in regards to kind of, you know, how this played out and kind of what happened. And, you know, part of this that, you know, to focus on too, is you actually had some areas here where Sting going up against someone known as the Black Scorpion. This is one that, again, like how this feud would play out like over time. And Tom, do you remember the Black Scorpion promos?
No, the promos. No, I don't.
So the Black Scorpion for those, he would really just kind of, it was just like a distorted voice. It would sit in front of the screen. You couldn't really make out anybody or understand who it was, but you had really Sting getting taunted and attacked actually on different occasions by the Black Scorpion. It was kind of after this all played out and kind of things happening, and kind of having this match. And what you had though was, you know, this match, or, you know, this match between the two of them taking place in July, and really Sting not knowing who the Black Scorpion was. Doing my research, it was played by multiple people like over the next couple of months, either, you know, depending on if it was a promo or if it was a bump that was going to be taken or something like that. It was different people that were this Black Scorpion. Well, of course, you had this feud between Sting and the Black Scorpion culminating. This was Starrcade, December 1990. And of course, who is the Black Scorpion at the end of all this? Ric Flair. So, you know, had kind of this weird where they've got this, you know, big angle where they, you know, the taking on the horseman, but then you've got like this secret, you know, Black Scorpion where it's Flair in disguise. And so it was just really weird to see. The promos weren't great. It just, you know, a lot of this. So it was a good build, but the aftermath and like some of this stuff, and I watched a little bit of it, just, I wasn't enjoying it. And so just kind of weird. But you would, of course, though, have these two. They would feud, they would team up over the years, just different things happening. You actually then, of course, had WCW splitting off and Flair leaving for WWF because of contract disputes. There was a whole lot of behind the scenes there that happened. And so really like kind of NWA breaking down and WCW breaking down and kind of everything happening. And so Flair leaving, what he actually though had, you know, Sting going on, continuing to have good matches. He would actually go back and team with Luger. So it's interesting where you had, you know, Flair feud, teaming feud, you had Luger feud, teaming feud, and then we're back to another team with Luger here. It was actually Super Brawl 1, the first one where the two of them, or what a lot of the lists had this one as the best match of 1991. It was Lex Luger and Sting versus the Steiner brothers. So, and that's one too, that's on our short list of matches to check out one day. So, just a lot of, you know, different things happening, you know, the Black Scorpion stuff, not fun. But this was very early in the careers too. And so these guys kind of where they went and what they did, and Ric Flair was always going to be Ric Flair. But again, this is a period too, where he ended up leaving for WWF.
That's right. Yeah.
So interesting though, how it played out.
Yeah, it really was.
So thoughts on the aftermath? You got any,
you know? Yeah, you know, I was just going to say before I get into that, it's interesting, like watching, you don't realize at the time how much better, and it's still to this day, Vince McMahon and his company and Kevin Dunn, how great their production is. Like, you know, you watch this match and it's like, man, there are parts of the arena that were empty and the lighting wasn't great. And it's just, you know, it's just amazing how Vince has always, I mean, been ahead of the curve. Even now, I mean, some of the vignettes they put together and the quality of the production, I mean, it's second to none. It's as good as anything the NFL's doing or anyone else. It's that good.
Yeah, it really is. It's surprising, but yeah, it's worth it.
So even if you look at like comparing like WrestleMania 6 and what they were doing in 1990 versus this, massive difference, man. Even when they weren't doing well, they were still producing better TV. So I say we jump into our payoff scores. I'll let you go first this week, dude.
Well, we got the reviews, and so
we'll
touch on that. And so it's interesting you keep bringing up that WrestleMania 6, because the 19th match of the year was Hulk Hogan versus the Ultimate Warrior. The runner-up to that one was Sting versus Ric Flair. So interesting how that – now, that was the match of the year, but the wrestler of the year, the winner that year Sting. By a slim margin was Sting, the first runner-up to that, the Ultimate Warrior. And so you had these guys, like you said, trained together, came up together, worked together, you know, probably knew each other, you know, what they were doing and could read each other's minds, winning match of the year and wrestler of the year or runner up alternating. Like, just kind of crazy how that played out. So, interesting though, that kind of the Observer newsletter, I saw the, one, I couldn't find a ton of write-ups on this one. It's just a period where that stuff's not out there.
Yeah.
But I did see that Meltzer gave this one 3.75 stars.
Okay.
And then a different write-up that I was kind of looking through some stuff and trying to find some different things. There's a site that was kind of reviewing it. Was Sting was made to look like a star as he overcame everything Flair tried to do. The crowd was molten hot for it, and they exploded when Sting won. They got what they want as Sting won a great match, 4 stars. Sting gets interviewed afterwards, though, and continues to put Ric Flair over as the greatest champion, but still celebrates his win. And so you've got really, 3.75 stars. You got 4 stars. Mika, there was just a lot happening in this match. Like, I'm going to give it a 7 because I did enjoy the crowd was, the pop and all that stuff. I agree with that one. Absolutely. And I think just kind of seeing, especially these two guys really, Flair had been around, but really Sting in his very, very early days, it was just cool to see.
I don't disagree with anything you said. I have it slightly higher. Big build, big new babyface champion, beat the legend, crowd goes nuts. I'll give it a 7.5. I think where, I would have liked to have seen a couple things. I would have liked to have seen just maybe one-on-one. There's a little too much, extracurricular activity for my liking. And I didn't like that Sting won with a small package, and it really wasn't even a well-done one. I would have liked to have seen something a little bit more definitive, and I don't know if the idea was, well, we want to keep this thing going. But I don't know, man. You could attack them, TV next week and get your heat back. I personally would have liked something, again, a little bit more definitive.
I agree with you too. I am not a small package fan. I feel like, especially
you like big packages.
I definitely like big packages. So anyways, wow, I really set myself up terribly for that one. But I think it just comes out of nowhere, which I get it. Like, that's the point, but it's just, the finish made sense, but still I feel like it's such a cheap finish too. So, yeah, I'm with you. I will never say something like that ever again. But yeah.
Didn't you say you're a big fan of John Cena's small package?
Yikes. Like that. I don't know. So, I know some people really like the jort look. So, hey, we'll just have to, you never know with that shit. So yeah, good stuff overall. You got any kind of final thoughts? We got 7, 7.5. You got anything else?
Yeah, I look. I just feel like I wish things had gone a little differently in Sting's career. He spent, and I get why guys went to TNA, right? You work 10, 15 matches a year and probably made decent money. Like, it was easy. It was like part-time, but man, I would have liked to have seen him, in this era in the WWF or not long after. I told you, I may be in the minority on this. The Crow Sting stuff, I just didn't do anything for me. And I love the guy as a person, as a wrestler, as a performer. I like the Surfer Sting look better. I like the energy. I like the work rate, all that stuff. And I would have loved to have seen him while he was still in his physical prime, against Steve Austin, against The Undertaker, against Shawn Michaels, and the list goes on and on. I wish he wouldn't have hurt his neck against Seth. I mean, I would like to have seen, you know, it's a shame. It's he finally enters the grandest stage of them all, if you will. And just a little old, a little slow, a little hurt. Personally, I'd love to see him wrestle one more time if he was up for it and he could get a good match out of himself. You know what opportunity I'm going to say exists, right?
Yeah.
You do some kind of a cinematic match versus Taker, but I don't know. I don't know if that's going to be that's probably something that's going to jump the shark soon. And I don't even know how much longer, but you know, that's going to get overplayed to death.
Well, I'll be interested, especially, how much more they do it. We've seen some different things, how they played out. And it's weird to say. And I think that could be one of the biggest what ifs of what if Sting had come over in like 2002. What if he had come over when everything was breaking down and kind of things happening? So, yep. Hard to say, because he didn't come over another 10 years after that. Just, it's just tough. And at that point, 10 years, and he had done 10 more years of wrestling at that point. It's a lot. So yeah, it's hard to say what we would have gotten at that point, but, we'll never know. So
good stuff. It's true.
But yeah, so we've got, of course, finding Ric Flair on Twitter. You have Ric Flair Nature Boy, but it's NATR Boy. So make sure to check him out there. You have Sting. He is just at Sting. He actually has beaten out the singer Sting for just his name. And so Sting has that going for him. And of course, need to thank Rick Bassman again, too, for kind of being here, giving his time, kind of telling the stories that he did. Like, that's just really good stuff. We enjoy that. He's been on a few episodes now, and he's just at Rick_Bassman. So make sure to find him as well, too. But just kind of good stuff. So, with that, Tom, make sure everybody at Payoff Pod, subscribe, all that good stuff, share, find us on social media. You got anything else to send us home on this one?
No, man, I'm just looking at our upcoming schedule and next couple matches. I'm super pumped to cover. They're going to be good ones. So absolutely. A lot of fun continuing our summer theme of matches, Jeff. So as always, thank you, everyone, for joining us on The Payoff.